and this session is the third in a series of four, the fourth and last being tomorrow. The series is called Worship and Its Arts, and on Monday we talked about architecture as one of the arts of worship, and on Tuesday we talked about drama and theater as one of the arts of worship, and today we're talking about language and words as one of the arts of worship, and tomorrow we're going to be talking about signs and symbols and signification. Actually, we could even begin with time, as I think I may have said on Monday. Anything that people do or make or treasure or find useful and helpful to them, I would consider part of art in the sense of culture. And all of that, you see, is pressed into service on Sunday morning in worship. I found my vocation, I should tell you this, I found my vocation 5 years after I was ordained. My dad was a pastor, and I heard the gospel, you know, every Sunday, and I loved my dad and my mother. I mean, I think I was raised in a nice Christian home. I went to seminary, I studied, you know, under some fine theologians, Martin Heineken, Kierkegaard scholar, and some others. William Lazarus was one of my teachers. John Rubin was one of my teachers. Anyhow, fine names now that have given a great contribution to the church. I was ordained and I was already a pastor for 4 years and a campus pastor for 1 year, 5 years after ordination, when I discovered my vocation. That is to say, having all my life been interested in all of the arts, theater, drama, painting, drawing, architecture, music, all that kind of stuff. From a child, I was interested in that kind of stuff. It only occurred to me 5 years after ordination that the place where all of these arts intersect with Christian faith is in worship on Sunday morning. Because you're dealing, you see, with this architectural space, you're dealing with these literary texts, hymns, prayers, that kind of thing, liturgies and so on. You're dealing with these gestures and these postures and these positions and so on. You're dealing with these vestments, these colors, the color of the church year and so on. All of that stuff came home to me, as I say, only 5 years after I was ordained. And I found my vocation then, and I started to write books on it and study more about it. Anyhow, it changed my life. To discover that all of those arts were put to work on Sunday morning. Now, let me tell you about Sarah Shantz, and then I'll move into our topic for the day. Sarah Shantz is what, 6 years old? She is the daughter of the campus pastor in Toronto. And I spent most of my life as a campus pastor, a university chaplain. And most recently, I've been a chaplain at Wilfrid Laurier University and University of Waterloo in Waterloo, Ontario, which is about an hour this side of Toronto. And I had occasion a couple of years ago to stay overnight with Bob Shantz, my colleague in Toronto, and the next morning he was going to take me to the Toronto airport. The Toronto airport is the easiest place to fly out for us. So he was going to take me to the airport in Toronto, and he said, stay overnight with us and we'll get up. You won't have to drive, you know, all the way from Waterloo early in the morning. We'll just take you 20 minutes up to the airport. So I did. I stayed overnight with him, and the next morning we were having breakfast around his table. And it was earlier, I think, than the family normally gets up so as to be able to take me to my early flight. But little Sarah was sitting there in her high chair, maybe 6:30 in the morning, something like that, maybe 7. But it was earlier than she was used to, and she was sitting there half asleep in her high chair. And Bob was preparing her cereal for her. And he put the cornflakes in the bowl, and he sprinkled the brown sugar on the top, and he reached for the cream pitcher. And little Sarah, half awake, said, not on the sugar. She didn't want him to pour that milk on the sugar and melt it all. She wanted him to pour it down the inside of the bowl very carefully so as not to wet the sugar. I mean, that was her little liturgy, right? I mean, she had this little ritual that was precious to her. And it's simply proof or demonstration, in my way of thinking, that human beings are liturgy enactors. Human beings are ritual makers. Everybody has a liturgy. Everybody has a ritual, not just Christians. And the only question, therefore, is it a good liturgy or is it a bad liturgy? Is it a liturgy that fits our situation or does not fit our situation? Is it a liturgy or a ritual that explicates and evidences the gospel? Or is it a liturgy that gets in the way of a proclamation of the gospel? I talked about the death of Marilyn Monroe a couple of sessions back and maintained following William Klebsch, do you know him, Episcopal theologian, that Marilyn Monroe as a public figure was murdered. No, she murdered, that was it, she murdered Norma Jean Baker, which was Marilyn Monroe's name, you know, before she became a movie star. And he says, isn't it a shame that our faith is always at the point of being murdered by its public embodiment? And should it have to be that way? I talked, I guess it was on Monday, about what I call in my classes back at seminary, the four C's: creed, code, cult, and constitution. And that's religion. And all of those four make up religion. And religion is always at the point of murdering faith. And ain't it a shame? And does it have to be that way? Creeds, those are our doctrines, our teachings, our dogmas, our whatever have you. Code, that's our ethics, our way of behaving. We're going to talk about that tonight. Is the church properly inclusive? You know what, our form, we're going to talk about that. Cult, that's ritual, liturgy, worship, and even constitution, church organization. As I quoted on Monday, Jesus says, where two or three are gathered together in my name, there am I in the midst of them, and there you will also find a president, a secretary, and a treasurer. I mean, that's just the way human beings are. And as I've argued with Sarah Shantz, what we're talking about this week in my four sessions is cult, ritual, liturgy. I laid on you, I told the group on Monday, what I will repeat for you today, that is some characteristics of liturgy or ritual. It is action, it's primarily something people do. It allows them to act out what is significant in their lives. It is corporate. It involves the total person. Body, mind, emotions, intellect, relational, political, the five senses. It's not just a left brain thing. And then finally, metaphor. And I'm going to extend some of these things today. Now, liturgy is, first of all, ritual is something people do. A lot of people have the notion, a lot of Protestants have the notion, that liturgy is talk. Or liturgy is words, and that's what we're going to talk about in a few moments, more specifically. But I want to warn you right from the start that liturgy is chiefly ritual, is chiefly something people do. What does Jesus say in the upper room in the night of his betrayal with the bread and the cup?
Do this.
Do this, he says, right. So ritual and liturgy and worship is more closely related to a game, even like a sports event, or to a game of Monopoly around the kitchen table, where you give yourself over for the space of an hour's time to the rules of that game. And words are involved, sure, but you're doing something, and you're doing something together. So ritual and liturgy and that kind of stuff is, as one of my friends says, embodied, enacted, and even ludic. Isn't that a nice word? You learned a new word tonight. It means having the character of play. Christer Stendahl, who some of you know, has Christer Stendahl ever been here? Oh, he should be invited. Do you know who I mean? Bishop of Stockholm, wonderful man. Anyhow, he should be invited here if he hasn't been before. Ludic means play. And he says, Christer Stendahl says, liturgy is the playground of the people of God. It's also the workshop of the people of God. We should sweat at it a little bit. We shouldn't find it immediately accessible necessarily. It should be something we're willing to stretch and willing to work at. I have a friend who says when you finish church on Sunday morning, you should come out wringing wet with sweat. Well, that may be an exaggeration, but I mean, we should not be ashamed or apologize for having to work a little bit, learning a new hymn, whatever. But it's a playground, too. It ought to be fun. It ought to be something like a game that you play. And it is pre or post Gutenberg, if you want to put it that way. That is to say, liturgy at its best is the kind of responses that I say, Lord, in your mercy, and you say, hear our prayer. Very good. You shouldn't have to have a text all the time. You shouldn't have to push your nose in a book. And that's a big mistake of a lot of Protestants. They think that liturgy is chiefly words. Now, we hear some great words at Holden Village, and I wouldn't want to, you know, say anything naughty about that. But I observe, for instance, frequently that in Matins, surely, in the dining hall, and a lot of times in Vespers, too, the leader will stand up and say, now, what I want to tell you tonight, or what I want to talk about tonight, or whatever, and that strikes me as being more kind of a speech, or a lecture, or maybe a sermon, but not so much ritual, or corporate worship, which is all of us together participating, all of us together on stage, all of us performers, all of us players in the field, so to speak, and God in the audience. And it's something we do. Okay, it allows us to act out what is most significant in human life. That's the point of it. When you greet your neighbor in the peace and say, the peace of the Lord be with you, you're not just chatting them up. You're not just saying, hey, it's nice to see you today to a friend. You're granting that person the peace of Christ. It is performative language, the experts would say. It's language that performs what it says. And it allows us to give shape and meaning to our lives, and therefore you can find ritual times, ritual spaces, ritual actions, ritual objects, ritual qualities, ritual language, ritual beliefs, ritual groups, ritual figures, and ritual types. Ritual types including rituals of passage, rituals of status conferral, rituals of status maintenance, rituals of status reversal, rituals of celebration, rituals of mobility, rituals of purification. I mean, there's a whole anthropological study out there that's going into this kind of stuff on the level of all the world's great religions, and they're analyzing Christian ritual in those same terms, and it's very exciting. And that's the frontier, as a matter of fact. If any of you find that interesting or exciting, that's the frontier in worship today. Not so much history anymore, not even so much aesthetics and art, as anthropology and what is called phenomenology. Anyhow, it allows us to act out what is most significant. I spelled that right, didn't I? Anyhow, when I give you the peace, when I say the peace of Christ be with you, and you say it back to me, and then we embrace, or we touch, or we shake hands, or we kiss, or whatever, we are allowed at that moment, you see, to touch what we have just prayed for in the intercessions. I'm allowed to embrace what I have just prayed for, namely the whole world. Okay, it's a corporate event, it's not private. There are private rituals, sure. And little Sarah Shantz with her cereal and the milk in the bowl. I mean, that's an example of a private ritual. The way you brush your teeth is an example of a private ritual. But there are corporate rituals, too. Opening night of the symphony orchestra season. 4th of July patriotic parade. The hockey game down at the wherever. We surround ourselves with rituals that give shape and meaning and coherence to our lives, and their corporate events, their corporate things. And therefore, I've got to trim my own prejudices and my own perceptions of the world and so on, so as to allow you to be able to say amen to what I pray. I cannot allow my own prejudices or my own perceptions about the world to hang out in ritual in such a way that you cannot say amen to my prayer if I'm a worship leader. If I'm a worship leader, you ought to be able to say amen to my prayer. So I got to phrase my prayer in a very careful way. And I have a friend who says she is more offended by prayers in church than she is by a lot of sermons. Because in a lot of the prayers, she is asked to say amen to something she doesn't want to say amen to. We could talk about examples of that. I won't go into it right now, however. It involves the whole person, as I said the other day, the five senses: hearing, seeing, touching, tasting, smelling. No reason why we should not have incense in our worship every now and then. I mean, that's one of the five senses. And the Psalms, Lord knows, the Psalms of David in the Bible give us permission for that kind of thing. Read what's in the Bible. My goodness, they danced before the Lord. They played the harp and the trumpet and the cymbals. And I mean, anything goes, as long as it builds up the body, because it is a corporate thing. And it's supposed to build up the body, not supposed to tear down the body. That's one of the principles involved. And because it involves a total person, body, mind, intellect, imagination, emotion, relationality, political, aesthetic. I mean, it ought to be all of those things. If it isn't, there's something wrong. And because it involves all of that, the language of ritual will be metaphor, figures of speech. I have defined a fundamentalist as somebody who has trouble with figures of speech, with metaphors. But metaphors is the language of the Bible. And again, Krister Stendahl says that the language of the Bible and the language of faith and the language of worship is the language of metaphor. It is the language not of science minus something, but of poetry plus something. That's the language of faith. We a lot of times think in scientific categories, you know, can you prove it or not? Can you weigh it or measure it? Well, if you can't, it's no good. I mean, a lot of us grew up with that kind of idea about language, and therefore we think, well, the language of the Bible and the language of faith isn't scientific, and therefore it's not so good. But no, it's its own language. It's not the language of science minus, it's the language of poetry plus. And the language of poetry is the language of metaphor and figures of speech, multivocal, mystery, illusions, figures. It's formalized language. It's repetitive language. It's stylized. It's patterned. It's condensed. That's the language of faith. Now we're talking about words, aren't we? And those are words that evoke and suggest lots of layers of meaning. Not just one meaning, lots of layers of meaning. That's the language of faith. Hence, as I have said a few minutes ago, this is the place where the arts meet faith. Ritual is the place primarily where arts and faith intersect. It's a corporate art form, you might say. It has a tradition. I define the tradition of the church in ethics and theology and worship and even church structure, I suppose, in terms like this. Tradition is a way of giving your grandmother and grandfather a vote in the decisions you must make today. In other words, transgenerational democracy. Now, a lot of people today, a lot of contemporary people think they have to, you know, be Oedipus and murder their father. And I'm here to tell you, you don't. We should try to honor what dad and mother loved, and what grandma and grandpa loved, and what their grandpa and grandma loved. And being a mature, adult, contemporary person does not mean cutting off the tradition and throwing it away. When the psalmist says, sing to the Lord a new song, that does not mean we have to stop singing the old songs. We want to sing the old songs. We want to treasure that. We want to try to learn to love what grandma and grandpa loved. Yes, go ahead. Interrupt me at any time, and then we'll have some time at the very end for conversation.
Yeah, I ended up being one that has gone over to Chicago to the main ELCA offices. I ended up, have talked with different levels on the ELCA offices, and they have, from people I've talked to over there, are saying like the LB, what is it, LBW?
Yeah, Lutheran Book of Worship, I got the version.
Because, yeah, I remember you showed it. It's because of its age now, it's starting to become a something of the past. Do you know if they are looking at any changes in that now?
A hymn book has about a 30-year life. And this book is now 15 years and maybe a little more. So, as somebody said, I heard a speech on this last summer, it's having its midlife crisis. Now, what happens when a hymn book has a midlife crisis? Do you sell your house and buy a Porsche and go off to live in a foreign country and divorce your spouse? I mean, you know, that's what happens to a lot of people in midlife crisis. But better advice, it seems to me, better advice would be to try to find things there, including in yourself and in your relations here, which you hadn't discovered before. In other words, you go back to those sources and you say, what has this got that I've been missing? And I recommend that with this book. Don't throw this book out. Don't scorn this book, including Holden Village. Dear Holden Village, do not throw this book out. If it were me in charge of things here at Holden Village, I would say this book has to be used at least once a week. Now, I would also say, let's use some experimental stuff at least once a week, too. But this is the church's book. And I'm proud of that book. It's a wonderful book. It was written 15 years ago precisely to answer the criticisms of, you know, we want it to be contemporary. We want it to speak to people of the day. And this does. This is, they threw out the old Tudor language, you know, thee and thou and beseech and vouchsafe and all. You know, you don't find that in this book. And that's good, in my view. Likewise, the musical forms are contemporary, believe it or not. That first musical setting of the Holy Communion, that's got syncopations in it and little dissonances that are right out of modern music. I'm arguing that this book is, we do not need to be ashamed of this book. Go ahead.
No, not ashamed, but let's be a little bit more realistic. How long did the commission work on that?
10, 15 years.
Yeah. Okay. Then it's really obsolete. It was really out of date, like almost anything now. But it really, I mean, you buy something and it's already obsolete. You bring it home. My computer that I bought just last summer is an orphan.
Yeah.
No. But the point is, really, one has to consider, if you're going to be realistic, 30-year life from conception, not from birth.
That may well be.
The problem is that there are some real problems in that. Musically, it was not edited carefully. And that really bothers me because there's no excuse for that, to have a book like that put out only by liturgists, theologians, and so on. And that really, really, I'm annoyed by the fact that there are some things that slipped through that should never have gotten.
Well, you win a few, you lose a few. I'm taking your criticism at its face value, and I'm agreeing with you. I mean, that is certainly true. I did not write anything in this book, but I was on the committee of the old LCA at the national level, among some other people. I was on a committee that had a pass on everything that was in this book, everything that ended up in this book. In other words, I had to say yes or no to stuff that was submitted. And I went through that whole process for 10 years, and twice a year we would meet with a great, huge, thick stack of documents, and we had to vote them up or vote them down, and I won some and I lost some. The hymns, for instance, have come under a lot of criticism because of their strange harmonizations, that you can't sing harmony to them. And there's a tradition in parts of our church, anyhow, singing harmony. And the book, the hymn part of the book, was put together by people, German, Bonhoeffer, following that line of thought that says all singing in church ought to be in unison. And I can sympathize with that, but I also like to hear harmonies every now and then. So, you know, that's a trade-off, and it's a judgment call. I would not defend everything that's in the book. I think there are some mistakes in the book. And I think it is showing its age, quite frankly. And I think there will be a new book, a purple book or whatever. I don't know what color it will be. I was at a conference, but I'll let you have the floor in a minute. I was at a conference a couple of years ago, and Gene Brand, do you know that name? He should be invited to Holden Village. He's one of our church bureaucrats now in Geneva, Switzerland. Very fine fellow. But he was the father of the Green Book. I mean, he was the chair of the committee that put all this together. And a lovely, fine, temperate fellow. I mean, he was not a radical, and he wasn't a high, ivory tower liturgist of that type at all. And may I say, this book was thoroughly field tested. They had these series, Contemporary Worship, remember these little pamphlets that came out, and congregations had the opportunities to use them and to give their critique and so on. There is no book in the history of Christendom that is as thoroughly field tested as this. Anyhow, somebody asked Gene Brand, when is the purple book coming out? That's your question. And his answer was surprising. He said, I hope never. He said, I hope the next book is a combined book, Roman Catholics, Episcopalians, and Lutherans at least, and maybe the Reformed as well. Wouldn't that be wonderful to have one service or a couple of services that were approved and endorsed by all of the churches? I mean, I think that would be marvelous. Do you know the document? Baptism, Eucharist, and Ministry? You should look at that. We should have sessions on that here, as a matter of fact. It shows an absolutely unprecedented consensus, agreement, among all the Christian churches, from the far right to the far left. I mean, there are Pentecostals in there, and there are Greek and Russian Orthodox in that committee. And our own William Lazarus was the one who pulled it all together, one of the people who pulled it all together. And it shows absolutely unprecedented agreement about what Holy Communion means and is, what baptism means and is, and what the ministry is and means. I mean, it's a wonderful book, and it lays the groundwork, you see, then, for a purple book, the next one, whatever that is ecumenical. Not just Lutheran, but ecumenical. That'd be wonderful. Go ahead, Mark. Oh, no, I asked this gal here, and then Mark. Oh, who?
Well, mine was on a little different thing you said.
Go ahead.
Did I understand you to say that when someone is leading corporate prayer or saying a prayer for the whole congregation, that person should be careful that what he or she is saying is something everyone in the congregation can say amen to?
Correct.
Okay. I know there's a woman in my congregation who makes no bones about being a racist. I mean, she's not even... She is, and she'll say that. I mean, she won't use that word, anyway, so does that mean that I could not say a prayer for the loving reconciliation of all the races if she can't say amen to that?
She's got to examine her heart, for one thing.
I mean,
there are certain issues in the Christian faith that are, as they would say in the Latin, status confessionis. Have you heard of that before? That's an A, status confessionis. That means a state of confession. In other words, to be on one side of this line means you are simply not a Christian. And for instance, the Lutheran World Federation made such a statement about apartheid in South Africa. The Lutheran World Federation has a statement, and we're members of the Lutheran World Federation. The Lutheran World Federation made a statement that said, apartheid is simply unchristian. If you believe in that kind of racist thought, you are not in the family. It's a matter of status confessionis. Now, most or a lot of issues are not quite that, you know, that do or die. I think it behooves this person to examine her conscience. However, your prayers might be able to help in all of that. Again, I don't think you want to rub stuff under anybody's nose in prayers. The place where you rub stuff under people's nose is the sermon. And I would say the sermon is the time and the place for the pastor to say, look, this is the way I feel, and these are my prejudices or my opinions on this or that subject. And not prejudices, you know, I hope we're not prejudiced, you know, in that pejorative sense. But this is my opinion. This is how I hear the Spirit speaking to me. And that's the, we ordain our pastors to do that. And there are other settings then.
In our adult form.
And right, and there are other settings then when the pastor can be contradictory. And other lay people can stand up and say, hey, I don't agree with that. The Spirit speaks to me this way. You know, I mean, we all have the Spirit, right? And we should honor that. And so there ought to be settings. There ought to be, and maybe you could try it on Sunday morning in a small group. Maybe you could even try it over here, you know, and have a kind of, dialogue in lieu of a sermon, where the pastor says, look, these are my opinions, such and such. Now, what do you think? And Walt Bowman, do you know him? He's been here, sure.
Yeah,
he has.
Been here.
He says that the prayers, particularly the intercessions, are the place where the Christian church argues with itself. One example. I was campus pastor in Syracuse, New York, about the same latitude as this. Anyhow, it was a Christmas Eve service, and we had little kids and old people there. And for a month, there hadn't been a snowflake in the air. And as was my custom at that time, at the time of the prayers, the intercessions, I said, what would you like me to pray about? And people gave suggestions, you know, Aunt Minnie was in the hospital or whatever, and I took note of these things. And one little girl, dear little Kathleen, she raised her hand and she says, can we pray for a white Christmas? This is 7:30 at night. And I said, well, okay, Catherine, I'll pray for a white Christmas for you, but I should tell you that there are some old people who have a hard time getting around on the ice, and snow means that the poor snow removal people, you know, the snow plows and so on, have a hard job, and it's even dangerous when it comes to the power lines and the people who have to repair them when they fall down from the snow. Oh, and I didn't quite go into that detail, but I did say, I will pray your prayer, but I'm going to pray another prayer too. And so at the time of the prayers, I said, dear gracious God, some of us want a white Christmas, and it would be so nice to see some snow. But others of us have a hard time with the snow and the ice, and we'll leave you sort that out. And would you believe the words were not out of my mouth, and the snow started to come down. We had 20 inches of snow. Anyhow, but I think that's the way our prayers are. We ought to say, Lord, some of us believe this, and others of us believe this, and we take it to you, and we ask you to purify our desires even. That's what the psalm says. The psalm says, purify even the desires of our hearts. There was another.
I just wanted to know, who did you mention in Geneva? Gene somebody?
Say it again?
Gene somebody?
Brand?
Oh, Eugene Brand, yeah, B-R-A-N-D. Wonderful man. Go ahead.
I'm going to continue what my line of thought on that.
Sure.
That what we may get through maybe a worship book, we can't possibly combine all those hymnals, even given the number of duplications, because for one thing, there's so many different versions of any one.
We could have options, you know.
I would, if we were going to get that, then I would say, okay, let's have a worship book, or if we're going to say at the prayer book, and let's have one's books with the hymns in.
Yeah.
But that is also what I think that each church needs, because we do need a common book of worship to unify us. But each congregation has its own separate needs, which in lots of cases are not really completely, or in some cases very poorly addressed by what is included in there.
Mm-hmm. This book allows that, of course. There are lots of different options within most of the services. And this introduction on page 8, which nobody reads, but on page 8 there's a wonderful page 7, 8, and 9, 6, 7, and 8, pardon me. There's a splendid introduction that you ought to read, and it says this, for instance, on page 8, having considered their resources and their circumstances, congregations will find their own balance between fully using the ritual and musical possibilities of this liturgy, and a more modest practice. A full service should not allow secondary ceremonies to eclipse central elements of the liturgy, nor should a simple service omit essential or important parts. In other words, you can use this book with a lot of flexibility. And I take, for instance, Marty Haugen's Eucharist, you know, Holy Communion setting, Now the Feast. That's a lovely new setting, really, that's essentially this. I mean, it's got a lot of the wordings of it, somewhat modernized, and a little kind of guitar-type music, and it's a lovely service. May I say, if you went to an Episcopal church these days, or a Roman Catholic church, you'd hardly know whether you were, you know, I mean, they're all alike. Even the words of them,
too, that we discovered.
Go ahead.
It was my understanding when this hymn book was going to be put together that one of the ideas was that it would be a small, standard, basic hymnal. And I think, back when you talked about that at a conference, mm-hmm. many years ago. And my question is, and with the idea that people could experiment with other types of things, so a soft-bound hymn books that could be
sure.
changed.
Yes.
My question is, what happened to that idea?
I argued for that, as a matter of fact, on this committee at the national level. I said when this book came out, it should be in a loose-leaf form. And I lost that battle. And I'm kind of glad I lost it, as a matter of fact. What happens when you have loose-leaf, you know, oh, you're always losing a page, or, you know, you get it in the wrong order. I mean, loose-leaf can be a real mess. So I was voted down, and they decided to publish a hard-bound volume. Now, you should know Worship Supplement 2. Have you seen that? They've got some of the material, anyhow, over in the Village Center. But Worship Supplement 2 is published by a Roman Catholic publishing house, would you believe, Gregorian Institute of America, and it has a whole bunch of new hymns that begin the hymn numbering where these numbers leave off. And then it's got the Marty Haugen Communion, and it's got a morning prayer and an evening prayer, a simplified form of morning prayer and evening prayer, too. Go ahead. Anyhow, that's a neat book. Every congregation should have that in the pew.
Does this really say somewhere on page 6 or 7 in the fine print that it's all musics to be in unison?
No, it doesn't say that. But the
that word never got down to the congregation.
Yeah, no, Dietrich Bonhoeffer says that. I should back up a minute. I was maybe confusing you. Dietrich Bonhoeffer says that congregational songs should be in unison. That there are no soloists who are out doing flashy obligatos or desk chants or anything like that. It should all be one voice. And within limits, you know, I can buy that argument.
But see, that's one of the things that went wrong with that. And it happened here, I've got it written down in one notebook with one of the hymns, that we changed and logically the parts are written in there to be played, some of them at least, are keyboard style rather than four-part choral style.
Right.
But if we're going to sing them unison, they're still way, way too high. They're still written for the soprano to sing the melody line.
You think these are high? You should go to the Red Book, which is the predecessor of that one. They're even higher.
This was supposed to be an improvement.
I think our human voices are getting lower over the centuries because the Red Book was pitched higher, and this was deliberately pitched lower. Still, in answer to your question, the people who prepared the hymnal section of this, there were two major commissions: the liturgy people and the hymnal people. And the hymnal people were very much influenced by the Dietrich Bonhoeffer, and also influenced by the Germans. Any of you have German background? If you ever go to Germany and see a German hymn book, it's just the melody line. In fact, they're not just Germans, but some of the other contemporary American hymn books are like that. I can't think of one right now off the top of my head, but they will print just the melody line.
So simply, we're not to have fun singing?
Well, yeah, right. Yeah, I'm with you. Yeah, I like to sing in parts too.
Well, yeah, I mean,
but that apparently is, I won't say a minority opinion, but it represents a section of the church that, what'll I say?
It's,
it didn't win out, I mean, quite frankly. And so the people who put the hymnal section together here said, let's make it tough for them to sing in harmony. Well, no, they didn't really say that. They said what we will do is, we will provide, this is their word, fresh harmonizations. By which they meant unsingable. And, no, no, I think their idea was this. Their idea was this. Let them go to one of the old hymnals if they want to sing in harmony. You know, you always have the red book around, right? Or you should.
No. No.
Did you throw out the red book?
Sure.
You should keep it. Keep it, yeah. At least for the organist. At least for the organist, you keep it. At least for the, you know, the musician should have it. And if I could just pursue this for a minute, so there was a thought in the tip of my tongue. Now, what was it? Anyhow, well, I'll give you an example. Is it three? What's the one? Jesus, Savior, pilot me over life's tumultuous sea. Is that the one? Let me take a look. Anyhow, there's one of these Victorian hymns are not my favorites. I mean, he walks in the garden. You know, that kind of stuff does not turn me on.
It's not in there.
No, it's not in here, but there is one. Jesus. Oh, Galilee. I know the hymn tune name, but I don't know the text. Let me look up Galilee for you. Do you mind if I take this time? Jesus calls us o'er the tumult. That's the one.
Your life's tempestuous sea.
Jesus calls us o'er the tumult. Yeah. I would not normally sing that hymn very often, anyhow. But in this book, it's got an un-Victorian arrangement. I mean, it's not easy to sing it in harmony, but it is really a fresh harmonization that makes me think about the words in a way that I had not thought about the words before. And I kind of like the way it appears here, in spite of the fact that it does violence to the Victorian character of it. There was another hand.
Me.
Go ahead.
Didn't the Missouri Synod have something to do with our freedom?
Definitely, yes. Missouri Synod's name is on the front page here.
Yeah, isn't that nice?
Oh, it's a terrible shame that after they said okay to this book, they went ahead and printed their own. I mean, that was a sectarian movement on their part, and there was no need for it, whatever.
Yeah, we got stuck with that.
It's terrible. It's a scandal in Christendom. Not the first one nor the last, I'm sure. Christians have a way of harming each other.
When you said that fundamentalism does not deal with metaphor.
Yeah.
Could you explain that just a little more?
Well, I suppose the easiest way would be to look at the metaphor, if we may put it that way, of myth. For instance, the story of Adam and Eve. Is that a historic, true story? Well, I would call it myth, the story of Adam and Eve. A kind of a poetic telling, as a friend of mine says, myth and the story like Adam and Eve, for instance, maybe Noah's flood as well, and some other things in the Bible too, is not a story of what happened, it's a story of what always happens. You see the difference? Metaphor, in other words, sees that story of Adam and Eve as the story of humankind. In fact, the word Adam, as you probably know, means humankind. God created humankind. And this is how it is with human beings. We're prideful and we're rebellious. And we're self-centered too often. So the story of Adam and Eve is my story and your story, and it's the story of the human race. So, you know, a fundamentalist would say, oh, gee, that's a true story, and there was a real guy named Adam who wore a fig leaf, and, you know, that's literalizing something that's meant to be a picture or a poetic figure. Now, there might have been such a person, you know, I wouldn't deny that, but that's not the point of the story. The point of the story is that it's a metaphor, it's a figure of speech for the human condition. Is that helpful?
Yes. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Some more? Let me go on here if that's appropriate. Adding to my list here, I won't write it on the board, but liturgy and ritual and Christian worship is meant to be popular and amateur and non-elite and common and koine. Do you know that word? K-O-I-N-E. It's a term from the Greek, and it means everyday language. That's why the these and the thous in recent hymnals, anyhow, were a mistake. I mean, Jesus didn't talk to God in a special kind of a language. Jesus talked to God in a in the common language of the day. And the worship of Christians ought to be in the common language of the day and not in the language of some other age. Or it ought to be koine, it ought to be common. Go ahead.
So sometimes then, therefore, I'm glad that we do not use the liturgy of the LBW because it has become so...
It's too common, maybe.
It's too common for me. I'm also church organist, so I have twice. So I get a double dose. But even at that, I'm glad when we do other liturgy because then I really do pay attention.
Then you think more about it, yeah. And we've had 15 years with this language now, and it can be kind of vain repetition, as Jesus would say. There comes a time when you get so familiar with something that you don't pay attention to it anymore, and that would be a mistake. But going back to the matter of special language, King James, the authorized version of the Bible, that's beautiful language, but it is, in my view, just more and more inaccessible to people. They cannot understand what the King James Bible is saying. Even the Lord's Prayer, I would never use the old Lord's Prayer any longer. If I could wave a magic wand, I would have people using the new Lord's Prayer. Lead us not into temptation. Oh dear, that's not really what Jesus says. Jesus says, save us from the time of trial. Save us from the evil one, even. And what he's talking about is losing your faith. Save us from that moment when our faith is on trial. So that's a much better... The new Lord's Prayer, in other words, is a much better translation than the old Lord's Prayer. I would throw away the old Lord's Prayer. Teaching it to your confirmation kids, anyhow, this gal.
Well, what about tradition that you were talking about a while ago?
Yeah, well...
Grandpa said this.
I like to think that Grandma and Grandpa would approve of the new version. I mean, what a hard time pastors had teaching confirmation classes, the Lord doesn't tempt you, lead you in temptation. I mean, that's just a mistranslation. Just plain inaccurate. And there are other inaccuracies in the King James Bible that the new RSV, for instance, the new Revised Standard Version, clears up. Go ahead.
One of the most difficult parts in language is translating poetry.
Oh, absolutely.
You can get anybody who can translate for meaning. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the problems with modern translations and one of the things that the King James Bible, those people who translated poetry, it came out in poetic form. Mm. And we have, now we have some people, I have the feeling that were responsible for some of these translations and for some of the modern liturgies who... were concerned only with accuracy of meaning, but had no feeling for the beauty of language. And that's one of the biggest problems with trying to get people to, because they can somehow instinctively feel that we've lost the beauty.
Yeah. A good example, for instance, of the problem that a hymn committee has when you put together a book like this, let me just show you one of the problems. Here is a hymn, a poem, by John Bunyan, one of the great English writers of, whenever. When was it, 1600s? Anyhow, he's one of the great writers. He wrote Pilgrim's Progress. And there's a great hymn. He who would valiant be against all disaster, let him in constancy follow the master. Now, that's wonderful poetry. It's part of the Christian tradition from way back. It's part of the literary heritage of Western civilization. I mean, it's that important. And in the new book, they thought that he had to go, that masculine pronoun. So they changed the masculine pronoun he to plural they. All who would valiant be against all disaster, let them in constancy follow the master. Now they're doing violence, the people who put this book together are doing violence to a great poet. But I think they were right. I mean, I affirm their decision. That is a very, very tough judgment call. And translating any language poetry from any language to another language is a very difficult thing. And from any age to another age. I think in another couple of generations, maybe Shakespeare's plays will be inaccessible to our children. because the language will have changed so much. I was in a version of Hamlet a year and a half ago at our school. I was Polonius. This above all to thine own self be true. And well, anyhow, I had a wonderful time. Wonderful play. Oh dear. But I said to myself, how much longer could we go, you know, with Shakespearean language? Do you have a point, David?
No, but I was thinking of the point you made earlier. If John Bunyan were writing today, he would have said they.
I think maybe so, yes.
But
I like the
really a violence to him, because we want our worship, we want all the worshipers
to feel
well included. And I don't think it's a violence to John Bunyan's art to change the hymn.
Sure. Well said. Something else? Okay, so it's common, it's ordinary, it's not elitist, it's homely, it's even vulgar in its own way. I talked a couple days ago about the difference between the Lord Mayor's banquet and the backyard barbecue. And that's the difference between high church and low church. High church are the people who like the Lord Mayor's banquet with the teacups and the six or seven forks by the side of your plate and the six or seven spoons and the soup course and the fish course and the meat course and a different wine with each course. I mean, I've been to such a banquet and it was wonderful. I loved every minute of it. But it's quite different from the barbecue we had a couple days ago, you know, out here with our cut-off blue jeans and our hamburger slapped in between, you know. What's the difference? Not in the nourishment. Not in the good times you have with your friends. The difference is simply superficial. The difference is the etiquette, the expectations of propriety, the clothes you wear, that kind of thing. And that's the difference between high church worship and low church worship. And they're both valid. For a synod ordination service, I think I'd want to have trumpets and timpani and vestments and processions and that kind of stuff, right? You'd feel gypped if you didn't have it. But a backyard or a Bible camp, you know, you gather around the campfire at Bible camp and you pass the bread and the cup around the circle and you have the guitar, and that's very fitting and very appropriate too. And Christ is present in both, and Christian community is enhanced in both. And you get fed in both. Somebody else? No? Okay, it is, this would be my eighth point, context specific. It is situational. Like ethics, I think we talk about situational ethics, and we also talk about situational liturgy. Contextual. It has to do with this time and this place, and you have to be initiated into the family's way of doing things. I don't think we have to apologize for the fact that you have to be initiated into how our family does things. And that's, you come to Holden Village and they do things a little differently here than the way they did it in your home church. And that's okay. You go to my house, as I have said, you go to my house for supper and I'll sit you down and I'll give you a cloth napkin and a napkin ring. Now, you may not use that at your home, but if you're a wise guest, you will look around the table and see how everybody else uses their napkin and napkin ring, and you'll catch on soon enough. And if I'm a wise host, I won't make a big thing about it, you know. I will try to be gracious and hospitable. But what I'm saying is that every family has its own little liturgies, little rituals, little ways of doing things, and that's quite legit. And we should not expect all of worship at all times and places to be immediately accessible to us. We must be willing to work at it. Go ahead.
I think it's very important, though, if we want people to keep returning to our congregation, if they're not of a Lutheran background, to, for instance, give the page number quite often.
Exactly.
And that sort of thing, you know, so that you're not just letting people stumble along.
And the person sitting next to you in the pew ought to be a good host and help the newcomer. It's like playing a game of Monopoly. You know, you've got somebody here who doesn't know how to play. I hope everybody else helps that person to learn the rules and play the game with fun and with enthusiasm. You know, you heard about the lady who turned to the other woman in church and she said, "Are you a stranger here?" And she says, oh yes, I've been a stranger in this parish for 15 years. Oh dear. I mean, that's terrible, isn't it? But yeah, that happens all the time in our parishes. Okay, it is judgeable, it is criticizable, it is, you know, this would be my next point, that we want to discern the spirits, and some stuff is good and some stuff isn't so good. And I think we have people like me, you know, to whom this has been a lot of fun in learning and studying, and we ought to listen to those people. And not just me, you know, I'm not coming off here as an expert, I don't mean to do that, but I have spent my life in this field, and I think I've got something to contribute, in the same way that a person who has spent the life in ethics or theology or whatever, you know, we want to listen to those people too. As I said a couple days ago, the arts require some discipline, they require hard work. And the artists who have been serving this week also would say the same thing. To be a painter, or a printmaker, or a weaver, or a basket maker, or a clay potter with a potter's wheel, that requires a lot of hard work. And there's nothing easier than being ignorant about that hard work. I quoted Jude, the 10th verse of Jude. Jude is only one chapter long, but you might look it up. It's the shortest book, or one of the shortest books in the New Testament. And in the Epistle of Jude, verse 10, it says, these people despise what they do not understand. And we should not have that said of us. And I quoted Corita Kent, too. To understand is to stand under, which is to look up to, which is a good way to understand. In other words, when you approach something that's unfamiliar, you should have a certain humility about it. Well, maybe they know something that I don't know, and the problem is not with the sender, the problem is with the receiver. We should have a certain humility about stuff that's unfamiliar, and say, well, maybe that person is trying to tell me something and I'm not getting it. I think that would be a useful way of approaching anything that's new. We gotta quit. Another comment or question? I think we'll quit right here then. Okay, hey, this was fun. Thank you. Yeah.